Hello and welcome to this entry in PER's Resource Center, Contextualizing Advances in Relapse Refractory Diffuse Large B-Cell Lymphoma, Navigating Biomarkers, Emerging Data, and Adverse Event Management to Transform Patient Care. My name is Matthew Lunning from the Nebraska Medical Center. Joining me today is Dr. Cami Maddox from the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. And in this video, we're going to focus on managing toxicities associated with new and emerging treatment options for patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. First, Dr. Maddox is going to go through and present a few slides to set the stage for our discussion, and we'll have some discussion intercurrently throughout this session. Dr. Maddox, welcome, and I'll let you kind of go through your slide deck here.
Thanks, Dr. Lunning, and thanks for having me. It's a little bit interesting to talk about just solely adverse events without talking about outcomes of therapy, but this is a good discussion. So we know that about 30 to 40% of patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma will have relapsed refractory disease. And for these patients, we now have a lot of different treatment options. When we're approaching the treatment to relapse, it depends on multiple factors. One of the biggest things now we look at is timing of relapse. Did that occur within a year of their completion of their initial therapy, or was it after a year? Are they a candidate for transplant if they had a late relapse? The patient's health status and comorbidities, disease biology turns out playing a role, prior therapies and toxicities to the current therapies we're proposing and the prior therapies. So for the longest time, you know, our only approach to relapsed refractory large cell lymphoma was an autologous stem cell transplant. I would say we use these much less frequently in relapsed refractory large cell lymphoma now. But for those patients who are candidates for a transplant and have a relapse beyond 1 year, this is still an option. So, you know, autologous stem cell transplant, it's just essentially high dose chemotherapy. So working through the logistics of that, patients require other salvage therapy and the potential toxicities that come with that, workup collection of stem cells, need for hospitalization occurs. Because we're just giving, you know, high dose chemotherapy, it's essentially all the toxicities that come along with chemotherapy, although sometimes in a worse or more pronounced setting. And really, you know, again, those include myelosuppression, infection, bleeding, transfusion, organ toxicity, and then there's a small risk of transplant-related mortality. So for those patients who relapse early or for those patients who relapse late and are not considered candidates for transplant, we now have CAR-modified T cells. We have two products approved in this setting and then three in the later line setting. And so this essentially requires patients' T cells to be isolated from the patients. They're engineered to express the CAR, modified, then they're sent back and the patient gets lymphodepleting chemo and the infusion of those products. So the logistics of the CAR require insurance approval, workup, collecting the cells, the period between collection and them getting sent back, the potential need for bridging therapy and toxicities associated with that. And then CAR potentially requires hospitalization depending on the product or the center. So, you know, CAR T cells have, you get lymphodepleting therapy, you give the CAR T cells, there's toxicities that come along with chemotherapy, and then there's toxicities that are unique or to CAR T cells or to this type of therapy like immunotherapy. So the big things we think about with CAR T cells, cytokine release or CRS, and then immune effector cell associated neurotoxicity syndrome or ICANS. But I think some of the other big things we have to think about with CAR T are cytopenias and infection. And then less common, but possible tumor lysis, HLH, macrophage activation, and then secondary malignancies.
You know, Cami, so as we kind of went through and thought about, you know, just this difference in our practice now, you know, between, you know, I basically timestamp, you know, when they finish their sixth cycle of whatever they got for induction up until thinking about a year later, you know, has your practice changed at all in kind of monitoring for relapse?
That's a great question. And no, it hasn't, necessarily changed, but the thought of like, should patients have, you know, a scan in that time frame before they relapse? Because if they are, is this probably the better option for therapy? Is a reasonable thought. Have you been scanning?
Yeah, because
patients?
I think you know, in thinking about toxicities related to cellular therapy in that first year, you know, I think we're learning a lot of responses are related to disease burden, but also a lot of toxicity. And you're going to highlight here cytokine release syndrome, which often blends into ICANS, and also kind of trying to get that timing of, you know, if it goes to 13 months in a transplant eligible patient, well, then you're kind of having to make the decision, am I considering them transplant eligible still? Or do I go down that secondary platinum-based therapy, understanding that it's 13 months instead of 11 months from their relapse, and really trying to discern, you know, now who is truly that transplant eligible, as we know, kind of more broadly, a CAR T-cell eligible patient population.
And I think as we treat more patients with CAR and get experience and we mitigate some of these toxicities and we're able to, you know, do this safely, the question really becomes, should our late relapses more appropriate for CAR than an auto transplant, just like the early relapses, right?
Yeah, and I think kind of in my practice, definitely the age of transplant eligibility has certainly went down several years now that you have options, and you have to stare a 70-year-old really in the eyes and be like, you know, should I do an auto transplant or are you just better off being served by a CAR T cell? Understanding that you have both the opportunity to have CRS or high grade neurotoxicity, but you also have the opportunity to have, you know, gram negative rod sepsis at day 8 in the setting of profound myelosuppression. You know, both of those probably lead to, I think, the same outcome, which is an acute rehab facility stay to get stronger. Your thoughts on that?
I mean, I completely agree, right? Like some of these can go well, but then when they don't go well and you're looking at a 70-year-old or 75-year-old that has to spend a month in rehab and then gets home and is still not really functional, you kind of get into that pattern of admission and readmission, and it's, you know, what have you done for their disease, but what have you done for their quality of life?
Right, right. All right, go ahead and dig in a little bit deeper to the CRS and ICANS for us.
Yeah, so CRS, you know, this is a systemic inflammatory syndrome caused by release of pro-inflammatory cytokines. This is characterized by fever, hypotension, hypoxia. Patients can have end organ dysfunction. This can really range from mild flu-like symptoms to severe life-threatening systemic inflammatory response. And so, you know, again, this can present fever, fatigue, nausea, headache, rash, shortness of breath, hypotension, febrile neutropenia. There is a consensus guidelines for CRS, and so I did just put the put that up. But for grading, as far as temperature, blood pressure, what support's required, and then hypoxia, the level of oxygen support required, and this helps us guide how we approach treatment to CRS. You know, this can be a lot: symptom management, fluids, antipyretics, oxygen, potentially cultures, and if they're neutropenic, antibiotics. But then we also have medications such as tocilizumab, which blocks IL-6, and dexamethasone to help treat CRS. And, you know, there are been, I put it a little bit later, but some studies looking at giving dexamethasone as prophylaxis in certain patients to prevent CRS. And there's even ongoing looks at giving, you know, other cytokine blockers to as prevention for CRS. And then ICANS, immune effector cell associated neurotoxicity, pro-inflammatory cytokines leading to endothelial activation, increased vascular permeability, and blood-brain barrier disruption. This typically occurs after the onset of severe CRS, but can also develop independently. There's often, this can manifest as encephalopathy, but patients can also have a focal deficit. So I essentially tell patients, basically any neurological sign or symptom that you can think of is a possible sign of CRS, from not being able to answer a question to having a seizure or stroke-like symptoms, you know, or some numbness and tingling. So the consensus grading on this looks at, you know, both that level of consciousness, are they having any deficits, and then also an ICE score to evaluate for grading. So then the ICE score uses this 10-point scale that essentially tests patients on different abilities. And you can often find that, you know, you'll find deficits in these things early on when patients are developing neurotoxicity.
You know, so one of the interesting pieces that I've learned clinically is, you know, kind of some patients run at a baseline of 9 out of 10 or 8 out of 10, you know, just based they're functional individuals, but they have some cognitive abilities that don't allow them to get to a 10 out of 10. So how do you navigate, you know, those waters through CAR T cell?
I think there's a few different things. I think that's why it's important to know the patient and understand, you know, the baseline, so you know when something is off or not off. We collaborate well with neurology or neuroimmuno-oncology colleagues if there's any concern on how we're going to be able to assess a patient to be able to get a good baseline of something.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it isn't required to have a 10 out of 10 going into CAR T cell, right? There's just sometimes that the writing, you know, you see my signature, it's not legible. I don't know if you could read what my our national bird is, a bald eagle. I'd probably be plus minus one there on a 1-point scale.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's some days where I have work fatigue where I would be very low on this scale. So, you know, treatment and evaluation for this: supportive care, seizure prophylaxis, dexamethasone, CNS workup to make sure that there's not something else going on. And I think one of the big things, and you even alluded to this earlier, is, you know, this can occur concurrently with CRS, and make sure that you're thinking about both of them and managing them. I think, you know, these are the things that we think about and we counsel our patients on. We make sure they understand, make sure families understand, especially for patients, you know, once they're outpatient or what they're getting an outpatient product. The other thing I think it's important to recognize with CAR T is there is cytopenias, infection, and hypogammaglobulinemia. So, you know, we deal with these like we do with other chemotherapy, but making sure that we're utilizing prophylaxis, you know, we're thinking about IVIG if people are having recurrent infections, and just understanding that some people do have prolonged cytopenias and immunosuppression. And here I just kind of highlighted, you know, we have two products approved in this second line setting for primary refractory or relapse within a year, and then liso-cel product is approved as those patients who are not considered transplant candidates. And so from the pivotal trials that got them approved, you know, looking at CRS and neurotoxicity in these agents, you know, the any grade CRS with the axi-cel in this study was 92%, with grade 3 higher 6%, median onset 3 days, median duration 7 days. Looking at CRS with liso-cel, 49% for any grade, 1% for grade 3 or higher, median onset 5 days, median duration 4 days. So a little bit of difference in the incidence of those and really the timing that you see them occur. And then neurological events, any grade 60% and 21% for grade 3 or higher with axi-cel, and any grade 12% and grade 3 or higher 4% with liso-cel. And again, these are the second line settings. There's different data in the third line or later trials. And then just to highlight, you know, second line axi-cel, most common adverse event that was grade 3 or higher was neutropenia and occurred in the majority of patients. Infections, about 30% of patients had prolonged cytopenias, grade 3 after 30 days, and then a percentage of patients that had hypogammaglobulinemia.
So how have you kind of sorted out cytopenias? Because I think, you know, we have the Cy-Flu cytopenias, and then we probably have kind of a CAR T cell related cytopenias. I've often called it the double dip. You know, you see probably in that day 20 to 40 range where the counts recover from the flu Cy, And then they kind of drift down again. And you just never know if they're going to, you know, they're going to sputter out at 1,000 from a neutrophil count, or, you know, 75 from platelets, or if they're going to go all the way down and have that prolonged cytopenia. Do you have any kind of gestalt on or predictive nature on how to discern what one they're going to be?
I honestly can say that I don't. If you have a predictive...
You know, there was that heme tox, CAR tox, that algorithm that I thought was very interesting. I haven't implemented it completely, but it seems to have some predictive capabilities of kind of who's going to be those prolonged patients. But it seems to be driven by just the inflammatory storm that's already preceding, and that's probably the burden of the disease in the marrow reserve. But I think it also is driven by if you have some sort of CRS event, you know, kind of during your stay, that that can be predictive of kind of that those prolonged cytopenias.
Yeah, I think, you know, and sometimes I think some of the cytopenias that, I mean, you have to manage them, but sometimes they're not always a bad sign, right? Like you'll see patients that are cytopenic and then they lose that, and that's a sign that you're losing the response.
Right, right. Absolutely.
And so say like lysosel in the second line, very, you know, same thing, cytopenias, infections, prolonged cytopenias were, you know, issues with this product as well. So moving kind of all past CAR T cells to some of our other targeted therapies. So the first regimen, the very first thing we had approved in relapsed refractory large cell lymphoma outside of chemotherapy was the BR plus polatuzumab regimen. And this was approved based on a randomized trial against BR. So, you know, the toxicities in this, now we use pola a lot in the front line. And so I think, you know, this can be applicable to that setting as well. But when they looked at there was a higher incidence of cytopenias and febrile neutropenia when pola was added to BR, but that didn't translate into a higher rate of high-grade infections. And while neuropathy certainly occurred much more with polatuzumab, and I think that's the biggest, can be the biggest toxicity of it, the majority of patients after completing therapy, their neuropathy either resolved or improved to a lower grade. We use this much more in the frontline setting now. I think the challenge in the relapse refractory setting is can be if patients have baseline neuropathy from their first line chemotherapy, and then you contribute to by giving them more of this. I think now a lot of times, you know, when you use this as if you don't get it in the first line and it's used in the second line, it's sometimes used as a bridge to CAR, and then you're not using as many cycles.
Yeah, I've not had a significant amount of peripheral neuropathy worsening just because of the limited number of cycles. I akin kind of it to BR or BV, you know, when you get to the double digits, that's when the neuropathy starts to truly sink in.
Yeah, so I think, you know, when it's used as bridging therapy, then we don't really run into that. I think in general, you know, this is an easier drug to give, or, you know, managing toxicities really is thinking about growth factor support for patients who are neutropenic, maybe needing dose reductions for neuropathy if you're giving them BR pola and they've had R-CHOP and have neuropathy from that standpoint. So then tafasitamab and lenalidomide is another approved combination in the second or later line setting. When you look at the results from that trial, cytopenias, diarrhea, fatigue were the most common toxicities. A lot of these toxicities are associated with what we see with lenalidomide-based toxicity. When they looked at toxicity after patients completed a year of the tafa-len, if they were to make it to that point, there was a lot less toxicity giving tafa as a single agent. Close to half of the patients did require a lenalidomide dose reduction. I think, you know, if this is used in the second line setting, you may be able to get higher doses of len, but I think in later line settings, the reality in our patient populations are probably that most patients aren't starting at the 25 milligrams where this trial started, because of baseline cytopenias when they're receiving this.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point. You know, looking at some of the real world data with Tafa-Len, you know, second line or third line and beyond, you know, really has been kind of the confidence of practitioners to truly give 25 milligrams of Len, you know, in that patient that has a creatinine clearance greater than 60. You know, in my practice, I'm still willing to give it in patients between a creatinine clearance of 30 to 60, but just with appropriate dose reductions, just because the body still feels, you know, that 10 milligrams in the setting of that chronic kidney disease. And I still think you probably have the same opportunity for disease control. Thoughts on that, and understanding you just kind of find the right dose of Len.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely correct. And I think, you know, you can use growth factor support with Len, right? So if neutropenia is your issue, that's okay to use that. I think when you look at the real world data, I think it was something like 80% of patients would have qualified for the trial. So you do have to think about renal function. You have to think about count, you know, And there were other reasons, like the number of prior therapies that obviously is just different, but it's from the toxicity standpoint. And I do think that, you know, Len's used for a lot of things. So I think there's a high level of comfort by a lot of physicians in using lenalidomide.
Yep. I agree.
And, you know, dose, we've talked about this, dose reductions, dose delays, growth factor. So there's three approved CAR T cells in the third or later line setting. So we've talked about axi-cel, we've talked about lysi-cel, but then tisa-cel. So these were all three approved in the third or later line setting before. Again, some differences when you look at any grade and high grade cytokine release and neurotoxicity between these three products. Now, none of these have been compared in a randomized fashion against each other, and none of them will. So you have to take some of this, I think, with a grain of salt. But in practice, we do see differences, I would say, in line with, you know, what we see.
Yeah, I think it's been an interesting to watch kind of Transcend now have similar landscape as axi-cel or bruxy-cel, depending upon what we're dealing with, and also line of therapy. You know, maybe you could comment on, you know, your steroid prophylaxis. You alluded to that with axi-cel based upon ZUMA-1 cohort 6 and now ZUMA-24 data. Is that something, you know, that you've implemented into your practice, trying to reduce the high-grade ICANS?
Yes. And so that is what I had next. And that is something that we've implemented into our practice, you know, really assessing if we think a patient will benefit from that steroid prophylaxis. And I mean, this is a talk on large cell lymphoma, but I think, you know, thinking about it in diseases like mantle cell, we're using a product that have those toxicities, like you can probably translate that benefit in those situations as well, would be my feeling.
Yeah, I think we've done the same thing with regards to any CD28 co-stim, where we're thinking that dexamethasone day 0, 1, and 2 are a great idea.
Yes, dexamethasone can be your friend. So then in the third line setting, you know, we also have these very nice therapies called bispecific antibodies that are now available to us. And we have two of those available, epcoritamab and glofitamab. So looking at safety profiles of these, you know, when you're talking to patients, the most, you know, cytokine release occurs with these bispecific antibodies, just like it can with CAR T. It really, you know, the majority, so this is the epcoritamab data. This is a subcutaneous therapy given indefinitely, looking at, you know, the about half of patients on the trial experienced CRS. The majority of those really were grade one, a few grade two. There was very few grade three CRS with this agent. Cytopenias and infection, it can be an issue with this. I think one thing, you know, that we learned with the bispecifics, particularly treating patients during the COVID era, is that if you, you know, provide these patients with continuous therapies that lead to continuous B cell depletion, that you are going to run into problems with viral infections in patients, COVID, but even some of the other viral infections, patients just, you know, have struggled to clear, in my experience. And this just shows, so there is a difference really when you're looking at the timing of CRS with these agents. So things that, you know, that are done to try to help mitigate CRS, both of these agents are given in step-up dosing to try to decrease that risk. You do see that the majority of the CRS occurs at a certain time frame. So with epcoritamab, it's when that first full dose is given at day 15, and the current recommendation is to hospitalize these patients, or, you know, for monitoring for 24 hours after that dose, because that is, you know, not all, but the majority of CRS occurs during that time frame. So in addition to step-up dosing and hospitalization, steroid prophylaxis is recommended with this. It's given prior to and then 3 days post in cycle one, and then if patients have CRS. And then infection prophylaxis is recommended, PJP and HSV prophylaxis. So glofitamab, similar cytokine release and cytopenias, infection, toxicities to think about and be concerned about. Similar to epcoritamab, glofitamab has a predictable time frame when the majority of CRS is going to occur. That is at cycle one, day eight, because cycle one, day one is actually obinutuzumab given. And that's another strategy to help mitigate CRS. The first dose of the glofitamab that's given on day eight, recommendation for hospitalization for 24 hours after that dose to monitor for CRS. And then also with that, it's recommended to consider hospitalizing patients who have CRS essentially until they don't have CRS. So similar kind of things, prevention and management, the step-up dosing, the hospitalization, considering rehospitalization for patients who have problems, the obinutuzumab to mitigate. And then same, you know, talking about infection, toxicity, viral reactivation, that's all with, you know, either bispecific. Of course, there's a difference in schedule, and that might come into play.
So from a bispecific standpoint, how does route of administration change kind of your thoughts on this EPCO versus GlowFit? Does that matter to you?
So I'll be honest, I do not really see I don't feel any difference or make any decisions based on route of administration. So if you're saying one can be sub-Q and one can be IV, it doesn't matter to me. Not that it doesn't matter, but like there's not to me, if somebody sits there for a certain time frame versus a different time frame, if you can get it in this, you know, seat versus that seat. To me, I think the bigger things that I think about are just the schedule and, you know, how often is it given, right. Is how many cycles are given, and then, you know, what is the risk of CRS, and can the patient tolerate that? Those are kind of the things that I'm thinking about.
Very good.
How about you? Do you think about that? I'm curious.
Yeah, I mean, it's also kind of what is being paired with, too. You know, I think we're moving into where we're seeing bispecifics trying to play well in the sandbox with others. And so, you know, if it's being paired with an oral therapy, then it might, a sub-Q may behoove you, versus if it's being given with an IV therapy, you know you're going to be there, you're already going to have your port accessed or have a intravenous. Yeah, but I do think that on the back end, kind of looking at fixed duration versus continuous dosing, you know, may matter, but I think the disease situation may matter there too. If I'm willing to stop, you know, for their large cell lymphoma versus if I'm just not confident that I should, then I may choose one versus the other in a landscape where there isn't, you know, a lot of data to support one versus the other.
Yeah. And I think as we move forward and these are given more in the community, that might play a role too, right? Like what does somebody have at their center and what are they able to give? Or if you're going to start something and you're going to transition it somewhere, what can they transition it to?
Absolutely. It'll be interesting to see if the community onboards both or just chooses to onboard one and get used to one versus multiple.
We have antibody drug conjugates. So we talked about Pola, approved in the frontline and relapse setting. Loncastuximab is an antibody drug conjugate directed at CD19. This is an IV therapy. Its most common toxicities are essentially cytopenias and liver enzyme abnormalities. This interestingly does have some unique toxicities. So edema and effusions, you can see pleural effusions, pericardial effusions, peripheral edema, skin reactions, which seem to be like a unique sun sensitivity with this drug. So, you know, with the cytopenias, thinking about growth factor support, dose delays, dose reductions, but then also mitigation of toxicity. So Lonca is given at a higher dose because they get good responses with the first two cycles, but then the dose is decreased. Dex prophylaxis is given before, day of, day after, ideally. And then avoiding sun exposure, which can even be, you know, sun through the windshield that can cause a reaction.
Yeah, I actually call this Lonca T Dex just because of how important I believe that the dexamethasone prophylaxis the day before, the day of, and the day after is to risk mitigating the edema and the pleural effusions with this, because I think this drug definitely has activity. It's just definitely what I call an internist drug, right? You got to do a physical exam, you know, early implementation of diuretics. If you're starting to see edema, despite the dexamethasone is important, especially if the patients are responding, to try and keep them, you know, on schedule, on dose, but also knowing when it's, you know, it's time to hold and give a little break for the body to reset.
I think the other important thing with this drug is that, you know, for patients who get a complete response, maybe they don't need to continue on maybe that's a patient that it's good to take a break from, because you do reach a point where some of these toxicities are very challenging.
Yes. So yeah, a lot of new diseases, or a lot of new drugs in this disease, which is ever evolving, you know, for us. And I think we've heard today some unique toxicities. Are there any other unusual toxicities with these kind of CAR T cells, you know, antibody drug conjugates, or now bispecifics that you'd like to make sure that clinicians know about?
I can't think of any. I will say that one other thing I just was going to mention was another antibody drug conjugate that is not approved in this setting, but we've seen data more recently, single agent and in combination, and that's with the CD30 antibody drug conjugate brentuximab vedotin. I think we're very used to using this in other lymphomas, you know, cytopenias, neuropathies that can occur with this as well.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see if BVR squared, based on the Echelon 3 data and kind of experience with both R squared and BV, really finds a place in the landscape of relapsed refractory large B cell lymphoma, knowing that there's a lot of jockeying right now in other earlier lines of therapy for kind of additions.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Like everything we talked about right now is essentially being studied in the first line setting, right? We have bispecifics in combination with frontline chemoimmunotherapy, tafa-len. We have CAR T cells in the frontline setting being studied. So as the field moves forward, you know, how we address, what do these toxicities look like when these are given earlier in lines of therapy? And then what do later toxicities look like when you're receiving some of these early, you know, and the challenges with giving therapies after them? Will be interesting to see all that evolve.
100%. Well, folks, the management of adverse events is an extremely important aspect of the overall disease management. And as you can see, that the story is getting more complex all the time. I want to thank Dr. Maddox for joining me today, and also thank you, the audience, for your attention. Have a great day.